This is Jody Peterson with the KVNF Regional Newscast. In western Colorado, mushroom hunting has long been a popular pastime. This spring, it's drawing even more participants as the pandemic drags on and people begin to think more about where their food will come from. You can find many types of edible mushrooms in western slope forests, like morels, puffballs, king boletes, and chanterelles. This story about morel hunting comes to us from Idaho, and perhaps it will inspire you to learn more about local mushroom hunting opportunities. Just one caveat, know before you go, learn how to identify edible varieties, and don't eat any mushroom you find unless you're 100% certain that you know what it is. Here's the Mountain West News Bureau's Madeline Beck with her story of forest foraging.
When I was little, my dad and I would walk behind our house in west central Montana and stare at the ground, and then walk, stare, for hours searching for that tasty, edible, and highly prized morel mushroom. And now I'm doing that again in rainy southern Idaho with someone else.
I know I'm in a good area because I've found them here before.
That's Krista Wilmorth. She runs a blog called Fungal Forager, and she's taking me along to look for new morel hunting grounds. Of course, she does have her own regular grounds, but they're sacred. Most people don't like to share.
And that's with good reason. When they don't have a lot of experience, many times what will happen is they will go and just take everything that's there. And if that was one of your spots that you had found, then it could not be very fun.
Wilmorth says finding morel hotspots is good practice for new foragers anyway. They have to learn the forest they want to hunt in, and even someone's most reliable spot can leave you empty-handed.
That's why they call it mushroom hunting, not mushroom finding, and that's why they call it fishing and not catching.
The most predictable places to find morels is where the ground is disturbed, like logging areas or after wildfires. But the largest burn areas Wilmorth and I walk through today are the occasional old campfire pit littered with some sort of garbage. We're not finding what I came for.
I think that looks like fungus.
Oh, I think it's insulation?
Oh, is
spray
it?
Spray insulation?
Oh. Yep.
It does look like fungus.
Wilmorth does say that picking mushrooms doesn't hurt the fungus.
You can think of it as the fruit of a huge organism that's underground, so the mycelium.
Hold on. For non-fungal folks, mycelium is the underground thread-like body of the fungus that harvests and trades nutrients with other organisms or dead things.
So the mycelium has spread around much, much farther than we can see, and just when the conditions are right, they will send up a fruiting body, and that's a way to reproduce. They'll be dispersing their spores that way.
But Wilmorth still leaves some little ones, or a few for other hunters. They can give off more spores to promote new growth, but by the time you find them, she says they've already given off lots of spores. Wilmorth holds up an orange peel fungus she found, which is giving off spores right before our eyes.
Yeah, it just looks like a little cloud of smoke. So those are just billions of spores.
For Wilmorth, being out in the forest isn't just about morel hunting. It's about finding all kinds of stuff and learning about it. I try to keep up with all the things she shows me.
It's a thimbleberry. It's a kind of chambered berry, like a
fireweed.
And it makes a nice tea.
It's a white cottony kind of stuff inside the stem.
So that tells you that you don't definitely have, shall we say, a laxative effect on some people.
It look like a little eyeball.
It might be called an ear fungus.
So sometimes you see things like this and you wonder, how did I never notice these kind of things before?
But she tells me foragers have to be careful. Know where you're going, have emergency supplies, and if you plan on eating something, check with experts if you're not absolutely sure you have the right thing.
Be 100% positive of anything you put in your mouth.
In stressful times, Wilmorth says foraging really forces you to put on your mushroom goggles and tune the world out.
If your mind is wandering and you're thinking of, worrying about the future, you're thinking about other things, you're not really looking.
But when you are really focused on looking, it's amazing what you can find.
Oh.
That is the sound of Wilmorth finding our first morel.
It took me a second, but good Lord, there it is.
It was to be the first of about a dozen finds.
There they are. A whole little troop.
Happy little troopers.
Back at home, I start prepping my meal. While my family used to put them in spaghetti sauce, sorry to any culinary masters out there, I decided to sauté them for a nice omelet. And you know what? It tastes... Well, pretty darn great. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Madeline Beck.
This fall, Colorado voters will decide whether gray wolves should be returned to the state. The last gray wolf, native to Colorado, was killed in 1945, but occasional wanderers have been spotted in recent years, including a pack of six in northwestern Colorado this past winter. Ballot Initiative 107, if approved by voters in November, would tell Colorado Parks and Wildlife to create a plan to introduce about 10 gray wolves a year to the state, starting in 2023. Controversy over the measure has been intense, and feelings run strong on both sides of the issue. Colorado State University recently funded a study about attitudes towards wolf reintroduction and whether media coverage accurately reflected those attitudes. The study asked 734 state residents about whether they would support wolf reintroduction and how they thought wolves might impact their lives. The study also looked at the top 10 Colorado daily newspapers to see what positive or negative effects of wolf reintroduction they reported. Rebecca Nemec, one of the lead authors of the CSU study, lists some of the impacts, both good and bad, cited by the survey takers.
Positive reasons included things like restoring balance to ecosystems, improving the natural environment, the opportunity to view wolves in the wild, or emotional and cultural connection to wolves. Whereas negative, people mentioned the concerns about threats to their safety, to the safety of their pets, loss of hunting opportunities, and potential wolf attacks on livestock.
Overall, Nemec says, the survey showed that 84% of Coloradans across the state support wolf reintroduction. On the western slope, nearly 80% of respondents indicated they would vote for the ballot measure to reintroduce wolves. The survey results are consistent with several other surveys that have been done since 1994.
We did find a higher level of support for wolf reintroduction than past surveys of public opinion in Colorado, but these past surveys also found essentially that the majority of Coloradans do support wolf reintroduction.
Media coverage, however, doesn't tend to reflect that widespread support, says Nemec.
What we've found is that the media articles really focused more on negative impact themes than those positive impact themes. The finding is consistent with some other social science studies of media coverage of conservation issues and carnivore conservation, and local media sources tend to focus more on kind of the negative impacts of carnivores on livelihoods and on local communities, whereas national coverage tends to focus on kind of these broader positive concepts like biodiversity conservation.
The November vote will show if most Coloradans do indeed support wolf reintroduction. In the meantime, 29 counties across the state have passed resolutions opposing it, including Delta, Mesa, Montrose, and Hinsdale counties. For KVNF, this is Jody Peterson. And that was the KVNF Regional Newscast. Thanks for listening.